The Broadcaster at 40. This week, WTIC celebrates 40 years of broadcasting. And throughout the week, we are presenting our story, the story of the Broadcaster at 40. The 1945 WTIC Hartford Current Mile of Dimes exceeded its 5 miles goal by 2 1/8 miles, with total collections of $64,071.80. In April of 1945, Franklin D. Roosevelt became the first president of the United States to die in office since the advent of radio. Many special programs were broadcast, and WTIC presented musical programming of mostly symphonic works appropriate to a period of national mourning. On April 16, 1945, the new president of the United States, Harry S. Truman, addressed the Congress.
Today, the entire world is looking to America for enlightened leadership, to peace and progress. Such a leadership requires vision, courage, and tolerance. It can be provided only by a united nation deeply devoted to the highest ideals. With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt. I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart.
Before the end of April 1945, a meeting convened in San Francisco. From this gathering of world representatives was to come the permanent body known today as the United Nations. As the meeting opened, the radio audience heard Secretary of State Edward Stettinius.
The Conference of the United Nations on International Organization is now convened. We shall open the conference with 1 minute of silent and solemn meditation.
On May 7th, 1945, NBC reporter James Stevenson's voice interrupted regular broadcasting.
An Associated Press bulletin just received from Reims, France, reports that Germany surrendered unconditionally to the Western Allies and Russia at 2:41 this morning French time. That would be 8:41 Eastern War Time. However, there has been no official announcement by the Allied Supreme Headquarters or from any of the Allied capitals. This is expected at any time, however, and will doubtlessly come simultaneously from London, Washington, and Moscow. Meanwhile, another bulletin reports that troops of the American Fifth Army have liberated former French Foreign Minister Leon Blum, former Austrian Chancellor Kurt Schuschnigg, and Germany's fighting anti-Nazi minister Reverend Martin Niemöller, and have captured Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, the former Nazi finance minister.
Keep tuned to your NBC station for later news.
In Hartford, Mayor William Mortensen spoke to a community exuberant with the news of VE Day.
Beaten into an unprecedented ruin, Germany has cried enough. Now we can turn unhampered against our adversary in the East. Now we can, in the Pacific, bring to bear the full and terrible tide of our fighting strength, along with that of our comrades in arms, who are committed with us to the equally absolute downfall of Japan.
And on the network, H.V. Kaltenborn reported from San Francisco.
We could have proclaimed VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, at any time for at least 2 weeks past, and it would have been a perfectly legitimate thing. Because obviously, in a war that is as far extended as this, that covers as many parts of the world, that has overrun all of Europe, that has left pockets of resistance in a score of islands in the Mediterranean, in the English Channel, in the pockets of France, at the harbors on the western part of France, in various parts of Austria, of Czechoslovakia, of Germany, of Denmark, of Norway, it's probably impossible that the war could actually end at any given moment, because no matter who is in charge in Germany now, he is not in such complete charge that he controls all the German elements that are still fighting. And we have just had a bulletin to the effect that even though it may all be true that Admiral Dönitz and General Krosigk have signed some sort of formal document with the Allies for a complete surrender, those troops in Czechoslovakia, who are acting more or less independently under their commander there, said that they would not surrender unless they were guaranteed free passage across Czechoslovakia back into Germany. Perhaps they don't realize the extent to which Germany is already occupied by Allied forces.
Back on the home front, the culmination of an intensive farm safety campaign, one for WTIC, the National Safety Council's first annual Farm Safety Week contest. The war in the Pacific came to a swift climax in August with the dropping of an A-bomb on Hiroshima. WTIC's foreign affairs analyst, Professor Andre Schenker, presented a program on the A-bomb on August 6th.
It is my good fortune, and yours too, for that matter, to have here across the table from me a man who has actually worked on the development of the atomic bomb. It is Mr. Conrad Bacon, a native of Middletown, graduate of Northeastern University, who happened to be home on a vacation, but who is employed at the Oak Ridge, Tennessee plant, one of the three centers where the bomb was developed. We're not going to ask Mr. Bacon to tell us about his experiments and his work, because that is not the sort of thing the government wants placed before the public. There are, however, some questions which Mr. Bacon may feel free to answer. For example, Mr. Bacon, what was your personal reaction to the announcement of an atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima? And how do you react to all those seemingly fantastic stories which have been told about the bomb and its tremendous destructive power?
Well, I was certainly the most pleased person, I believe, in the world when I came down that afternoon and saw the headlines that the atomic bomb had finally been hurled against the Japanese. And that represented probably one of the highest points in my life, because we had been struggling so desperately for the last two years to produce the weapon, and so much time and effort gone in that it certainly would be a tremendous thing that if it really did come out, and boy, it really did.
Well, what about all these stories we see in the newspapers about moving a ship from New York to Liverpool on a small satchel of summed up atoms or some things of that sort? Doesn't that seem ridicule or what?
No, that's perfectly true. And as our development of this atomic bomb goes on, why, there's no question that we will be able to seize control of it. And the figures that have been given out so far on the power of the bomb will certainly be exceeded in the next very few years. And, of course, with the striking success we've had, there's no question that what President Truman will certainly push to the utmost of his ability and the ability of the scientists and physicists in the country to perfect this wonderful bomb and tie it down so it serves the human race.
When you think that the discovery is even more valuable to peacetime endeavors than they are going to be in the defeat of Japan.
Well, it's hard to say, but it's one of those things. It's like the radio when it first came out. A lot of people said, well, it wasn't going to be too good, and it wasn't for a while, but it's very few years, maybe 10 years at the most, why things came along. So one of the most powerful influences we have today in world affairs and education and religion, and this wonderful force that we're just barely peeking on the horizon now will certainly be multiplied many thousandfold when it's controlled by us and put to work for our human betterment.
Mr. Bacon's prediction that the atom would be harnessed for human betterment came true quickly. But in 1945, it was difficult for the world to comprehend just what this new atomic power meant. Japan offered to surrender, but there was a hitch contingent in the offer. The man on the street had special feelings on the subject of the surrender proposed by the Japanese, as Bernard Mullins and Bob Steele learned when they took to the streets of downtown Hartford with TIC microphones.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bernard Mullins of station WTIC speaking to you from downtown Hartford, from the very hub of its activity on Main Street near the old State House in the Isle of Safety. Today's news has put us all on the proverbial horns of a dilemma, and while statesmen all over the world are attempting to make up their minds just what the right and just decision should be, so are we ordinary folk, the men and women on the street, weighing in our minds the various angles to Japan's offer to give up with a string attached to it. If ever our leaders wanted to hear the voice of the people, they surely will want to hear it now. So I'm going to ask some of these passers-by to come to the microphone and give us their views. Will you come up to the microphone, please? What is your name, please?
T5 Pearson.
What field of operations have you been in?
I've been in the European theater of operations.
Now, what do you think of Japan's offer?
Well, it's a hard question to answer right at present. I do want the war to end as much as the people in the Pacific, but I do not want Japan to dictate to us in any way.
Well, do you think that if we grant Japan's request, that we'll be admitting that the emperor is not one of the guilty leaders?
Well, I believe we would, in a way.
Now, what do you think the other boys out there would think about this offer?
Well, the boys in the Pacific certainly would want this war to end, irregardless of who was left there to control Japan.
I see. Well, thank you very much, Corporal. Now, Bob Steele is with me, and he has a lady here that he's going to talk to you.
Thank you, Bernie. Here's the lady, mother of two young daughters. What is your name?
Natalie Winters.
Natalie Winters?
That's right.
Of Hartford?
Moved here recently.
Where did you come from?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charlotte, North Carolina. Have you any relatives in the service, Miss Winters?
Yes, I have my husband's brother and a brother.
And where is he?
New Guinea and Okinawa.
Two in the service, I see. Then you must have some very definite ideas about this war and trying to wind it up. Of course, you've heard today's news that Japan is willing to surrender with a proviso. They want to retain Hirohito as emperor and the spiritual leader of Japan. Now, do you think that we should continue to bomb Japan and fight the Japs until they ask us for peace under any conditions? Or do you think we ought to say, okay, let's stop the fighting right now. We'll allow you to keep Hirohito. What do you think about that?
No, I think we should bomb them. Get it over with.
Continue right through to the end until they ask us for peace on our terms only. Is that right?
That's right. That's the way I feel about it.
It was August 14th, 1945, when...
The National Broadcasting Company interrupts all its programs for a special broadcast.
This is Morgan Beatty in the NBC newsroom in Washington. The news corps at the White House, exactly 4 minutes ago, was called in from the paper-littered press room in the West Wing to President Truman's private office, an office that's about a quarter of a block across the building. The newsmen and women, incidentally, there are several of them in this corps now, hope and believe they will be given the whole story of the Japanese surrender note. They're inside with the president now. That's the note promised nearly 12 hours ago by Radio Tokyo. The note that NBC's Dr. Max Jordan told us. It seems to me the men are coming out now. I hear loud voices. Hello, Ralph Howard Peterson at the White House. What is it? Just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, the president has just announced full acceptance of the unconditional surrender terms submitted to us by the Japanese. Go ahead, Ralph Howard Peterson. The Emperor of Japan has just specified, in this message we have from President Truman, full acceptance of the Potsdam Ultimatum that was issued, as you'll remember, during the Berlin Conference. Now go ahead, Ralph Howard Peterson, with more. Mr. Peterson reports that President Truman told the newsmen that our arrangements are now being made for the consummation of the unconditional surrender of the Japanese. I presume these are military arrangements, are they, Ralph? That's right. They'll be made at the earliest possible moment by the Allies, acting in concert, I assume. All right. Ralph Howard Peterson reports from the White House that General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed Allied Supreme Commander for the occupation forces of the Allies. that will take over Japan as a result of the submission to the Potsdam Ultimatum. You will remember that at Potsdam it was specified that the Allies would occupy strategic parts of Japan to guarantee that the surrender would be carried out. Now, General MacArthur has been appointed as the officer for all of the Allies, all four of the major powers, to carry out that occupation.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the studios of WTIC in Hartford, we are proud to present on this great day of victory the governor of the state of Connecticut, Raymond E. Baldwin.
My fellow countrymen, we have heard the glorious announcement from our president of the unconditional surrender of Japan. The long-hoped-for day of victory has come. Japan, the last of our arrogant, heartless enemies, has been forced to surrender the price of her treachery and cruelty. Our minds and hearts turn first to the brave souls whose courage and sacrifice in battles almost beyond number have brought this great day in our lives to pass. They have faithfully kept a rendezvous with destiny. They have done what had to be done. They have given what had to be given for their country, for their loved ones, for the cause of human freedom here at home and everywhere. Their glory shines before a rescued world.
But WTIC continues its local and statewide coverage. We take you to Main Street, Hartford.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Floyd Richards speaking to you from downtown Hartford. It's a remote corner of the square. That is Main Street, Pearl Street, and Asylum Street. And when I say remote, well, it's just about the remotest place that you could find. And that, well, there isn't such a place in Main Street in Hartford tonight. The Main Street is just a seething mass of people, such a throng as you've never seen in your life. I can't talk. I'm too joyous at the occasion myself. What I'm trying to say is that automobile traffic is just impossible. There hasn't been an automobile go down Main Street, I would judge, in the past 45 minutes. And people are still walking around. There have been bands out here of all sorts and descriptions. People just milling around. And when soldiers go up and down, well, they get everything from a glad how do you do to a great big kiss from some beautiful girl. And we have seen that tonight, too. Ross Miller is here with me on the street, and we're going to try to get some of the reactions of the crowd down here. So, Ross, I see that you have a beautiful young lady over here. Would you mind interviewing her for us?
Certainly, Floyd. Good evening, everyone. What was your first impression when you first heard the news of VJ Day?
Well, I went wild like everyone else did. And
by the way, what's your name?
My name is Beatrice.
I see. And do you have anyone in the service?
Well, yes, I have a friend in France.
Friends in France, I see. And where were you when it all happened? Were you right down here the very first thing?
No, I was home, but I immediately took a bus and went downtown and joined the mad mob.
I see. Well, what's your impression of the crowd here tonight? Do you think you'll be able to get home?
No, I don't think so, and I don't care.
Hartford had settled down again and was concentrating on doing its part to welcome thousands of GIs back into the community by September. Opera lovers were first to receive a special treat that month when, on September 2nd, the first program of Your Box at the Opera was aired. Fire's disastrous tongues brought grief to Hartford's Christmas Eve in 45, when flames burst from the Nile Street Hospital. The alarm was sounded, ironically, just 2 weeks after WTIC's general manager, Paul W. Morency, had issued a memorandum calling upon the station's staff to, quote, "let your ingenuity and imagination run riot" in the presentation of plans for a year-long fire safety program during the coming year. The arrival of 1946 saw the station embarking on a major fire safety campaign, which was to bring it national recognition and acclaim. In July of 46, Frank Atwood, former assistant to the editor of publications at the University of Connecticut, began his duties as WTIC's farm program director. In addition to the Farmer's Digest program, Frank continued to conduct the weekly Connecticut Farm Forum. Also in July, WTIC broadcast a description of the arrival in the Connecticut River of LST 722, a Navy ship to be used as headquarters for Hartford units of the Naval Reserve.
Hello, Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Bob.
A good morning to enjoy Piano Moods and Songs of Acadia with Laura Godet.
Laura Godet, the station's first staff pianist, returned to the airways with the program Songs of Acadia in March 1946.
The ballet has been a source of inspiration to many of the classic composers, and Franz Schubert was no exception. By the way, does ballet music have a mood, Laura?
Yes, indeed, Bob. Ballet music gives expression to many moods. Lyrical, fantastic, sombre, pastoral, gay, and pensive. The ballet music from Schubert's Rosamunde.
And in 1946, WTIC was honored by NBC as the network celebrated its 20th anniversary. Through the facilities of NBC, WTIC listeners heard President Harry S. Truman address the official opening session of the United Nations on October 23, 1946.
The United States believes a concerted effort must be made to break down the barriers to the free flow of information among the nations of the world. We regard freedom of expression and freedom to receive information, the right of the people to know, as among the most important of those human rights and fundamental freedoms to which we are pledged under the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which is meeting in November, is a recognition of this fact. The organization is built upon the premise that since wars begin in the minds of men, the defense of peace must be constructed in the minds of men.
Preparations were underway at the station's Avon transmitter for the installation of a new 50,000-watt transmitter early in 1947. WTIC celebrated 22 years of broadcasting that February 10th. On that occasion, the assistant general manager, the late Walter Johnson, and the plant manager, the late Herman Taylor, were guests of Betty Petit and Floyd Richards on the Radio Bazaar to recount some of those early days.
Was there a Radio Bazaar then, Walter?
There certainly was.
Oh, there was.
We didn't call it the Radio Bazaar. In those days, and I think we started early in 1925, when we first went on daytime, as a matter of fact. Originally we were only on two nights a week for a couple of hours, Tuesdays and Friday nights. But when we went into a daytime schedule of broadcasting, we instituted a program which was called Shopping with Susan. Remember that, Herman?
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Patterson out in West Hartford conducted that program for quite some time, matter of years.
When did it become the Radio Bazaar? I know it was a long time ago because I can remember it being the Radio Bazaar 11 years ago.
Gosh, I don't remember.
15 years ago.
15 years ago?
15 years.
Well, that's a long
time.
Quite
a long time.
I'm feeling older and older.
Floyd, you'll get a kick out of this. I remember one night, Mrs. Patterson called up and said that because of illness, she'd be unable to be in the next morning. And in those days, we didn't require that program material be in the file several days in advance of broadcast. So here we were with a beautiful half hour scheduled for the air the next morning and nobody to do it. Well, that night I went home with several cookbooks, magazines, and whatnot, and wrote a half-hour Shopping with Susan program and presented it the next morning. You should try that sometime, when Betty doesn't show up.
You were the main program, Walter?
I was what?
You were the main
I was Susan
main
that
program
day.
Was Susan.
That's right.
Walter, now known as Susan.
Betty, remember the night that we had a snowstorm, I think, in late in 25, and no entertainer showed up, and they put Burtwood and I with a mandolin and Burton's guitar.
Oh, that's right. In those days, you played a mandolin.
We were the...
That goes back to your seafaring days.
Yeah, we were a duo then that night.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
That's right.
Well, your very first program, the first program, was on February 10th.
That was the formal opening of WTIC, February 10th, 1925.
Were you both here then?
I wasn't. I wasn't here until a couple of days later, but Herman was here.
I was here February the 10th. As a matter of fact, the first actual program, which was a test program, went on December the 22nd, 1924. It was the first concert of the Travelers Choral Club of 50 voices, and Professor W.B. Bailey was our first announcer in the sense that he introduced each carol as it was sung. So that our first musical program took place on December 22nd, although we celebrate February 10th as the anniversary.
That was the formal opening of the station on February 10th.
That's right.
Musical programs were still being originated from the studios in 1947.
Here's a light-hearted memory melody, encored by Rudy Martin and the orchestra. A very important question to those who don't believe in the old adage, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Do you ever think of me?
The announcer with Rudy Martin was Ed Anderson. Ed was later to team with the station's new director of women's activities, Jean Colbert, a former network actress. Jean joined us in 1947.
Is there a dreamer in the house?
Yeah!
Well, let's dream of a Cinderella weekend. Morning, everybody. This is Bob Tyrrell. Your quizzing coachman welcoming you to the first Cinderella Weekend program broadcast from the air-conditioned Orchid Room at Ryan's 33 Pearl Street in the heart of Hartford. Perhaps right here in our audience today is the very lady who will win a complete new outfit to wear on a glamorous, exciting weekend in New York, all expenses paid. Each day we find a new Cinderella, and on Friday the champs meet in the grand finale to determine which contestant wins the wonderful Cinderella Weekend.
Cinderella Weekend was a new audience participation show in 1947, emceed by Floyd Richards and Bob Tyrrell, the show gave lady contestants the right to compete for a weekly, all-expense-paid Cinderella weekend in New York City.
Hello.
Hello.
May I have your name, please?
Mrs. Ann McSwiggin.
McSwiggin?
Yes.
That's a nice name, isn't it? What is that?
Well, Irish.
What is it Irish? Oh, I think you're kidding me. You live in Hartford, Mrs.
Yes,
McSwiggin.
Yes, I do.
Whereabouts?
295 Lyne Street.
Lyne Street?
Yes, sir.
Have you lived here long?
About 17 years.
17 years? Do you have a family?
Yes.
Tell me about them.
I have a boy, 15, and a girl, 13.
Oh, that's a nice family. 15 and 13.
will add 15 minutes to your Cinderella clock for each item you name which can be purchased for a nickel. You have 20 seconds to answer. Here we go.
Candy, gum, hairpins, napkins, lollipops, handkerchief.
I have six. I think I'm almost right. Anyway, the time has taken you out till 1:30, Mrs. McSwiggan. Nice work.
I wonder how many of those things named can still be bought for a nickel.
It's smart to mind your manners.
Yes, here we go again. It's Alan Ledden, his panel of typical teenagers, and America's outstanding program for young people, Mind Your Manners.
So come on in, friends. We're here to talk about the problems that face today's teens, and you're all invited.
Mind Your Manners made its debut on November 8th, 1947, with Alan Ludden. The program was designed to emphasize the importance of good manners among young folks. Youngsters were invited to mail questions to the program pertaining to actual problems of social etiquette, attitudes, and behavior. Cash awards were given those questions used on the air. Panel members were chosen from area teenagers to help answer the questions.
Thank you, Bruce Kern, and hello there, everybody. It's good to have you with us. You, our listening members, have sent us some mighty fine problems to consider, and on hand to consider them is a panel of typical teenagers. So let's get this meeting started. The first item of business is for you to meet today's panel, and here they are to introduce themselves. Come in, panel.
Janet Bronson, 17 years old, high school senior.
Joan Wilson, 16-year-old, high school senior.
Joan Billups, 16-year-old, high school junior.
Lou James, 18 years old, college sophomore.
Tommy Keena, 18 years old, June graduate.
John McGuinn, 17 years old, high school senior.
Good to see you, panel. Let's go to work. Problem number one for this meeting comes to you from a young man. He lives in Detroit, Michigan, and for writing to Mind Your Manners, he's going to receive a wonderful portable RCA Victor 45 record player with the world's fastest record changer.
My girl's just like the girl in the song, she's never been kissed. We don't go steady, but I date her a lot, and she's a wonderful person. She's very popular and is liked by everyone. The only drawback is that she just hates to be kissed. It's not only me. She won't kiss any boy she dates. Now, a fella doesn't feel right when his girl will only let him hold her hand. What can I do or say without making her think I'm forcing myself on her?
Lou, have you ever known a girl like this?
Well, yes, Mr. Ludden, I guess I have. And what I have to say may come as a shock to some of the men in our audience, but although all girls wear dungarees on Saturday afternoons and use home permanents, they're not all alike.
They're not.
No, some girls think a kiss is just a good way to say thank you. Well, that's all well and good. But others, well, it means a little more, and I guess this girl is just one of the others.
You mean there are girls who think a kiss is a very important
thing? A kiss really means something to some girls.
Well, now, do you think this fella ought to feel funny, though, about going with a girl that just won't kiss him? He says it doesn't feel right when you only have to hold her hand. What do you think the boy ought to do, quit going with a girl or force himself more on her?
Well, I think he's on the right track. He says he doesn't want to force himself on her, and that's about the best thing to do, just let things go along the way they are.
A Connecticut landmark reappeared on December 1st, 1947, when the Traveler's Beacon brightened the city sky with its installation of powerful new lamps. In 1948, WTIC initiated a unique new program for farm youth in southern New England. I'd like to ask Frank Atwood, the man in charge of the program, to expand on it.
Dick, I'd like very much to talk about the WTIC farm youth program. It is unique, and I use that word with care. It is, really. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the country that we have ever heard of. It's a loan program to help boys and girls who are on farms or at least live in the country where they can take care of an animal to buy good purebred heifer stock. It can be either a dairy breed or a beef breed. But the point is we want them to get a good animal to have as a good foundation for a herd if they go on and develop a herd. And these animals are more expensive than the ordinary grade calf. So that the amount of money involved for a 10, 11, 12-year-old youngster is probably more than he can get up, you see. We give him a loan for the full amount of the purchase price ordinarily, and we charge him no interest, and we let him keep the money for approximately 2 years. It's based on the age of the heifer. He pays us back when the heifer reaches the age of 2.5 years, and normally they're bought at about 6 months of age, so they keep the money for 2 years. Now, he can earn the money by various ways, mowing lawns, shoveling snow, working for his father, you know, and get the money and pay us back. And then he's got one good foundation animal, and he can go on and get another one and another one. And some of these boys, particularly, have had a series of loans, one after another, and pretty soon you'll find them paying back the money long before it's due so that they can borrow again by another heifer.
Oh, that's a wonderful investment, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Now, how do you qualify for a loan?
Well, a boy or a girl must be a member of a 4-H club or a student of vocational agriculture in a high school, because we must have somebody out there that can supervise the project. Obviously, I can't do it for 100 or more boys and girls scattered over 2 states. Perhaps the first qualification I should have mentioned is that they must live either in Connecticut or Massachusetts. And they must have their parents' consent and approval, and they must have the approval and recommendation of either their 4-H club county agent or their vocational agriculture teacher.
The station no longer employed a regular staff of musicians in November of 1948, but it was still vitally interested in the furtherance of good music in the community. A gift of $30,000 was pledged to the Symphony Society of Greater Hartford to help finance the Hartford Symphony Orchestra, thus stimulating interest in the advancement of music and music appreciation, and in the creation of incentives for promising young talent. This was another milestone in the history of WTIC's leadership in the development of capable musicians recruited locally. During a period of almost a quarter of a century, WTIC symphonic ensembles and dance bands had presented thousands of programs over the coast-to-coast network of NBC. As many as 45 instrumentalists were employed regularly by the station at one time. Many of these musicians, profiting by their experience under competent WTIC conductors, later became members of the nation's great symphony or dance orchestras. WTIC's gift to the local symphony inspired other substantial donations and activated a subsequent public campaign for funds. The Hartford Symphony Orchestra made its network radio debut on Saturday, January 14, 1950, in a broadcast from the Bushnell Memorial. The broadcast represented the second program in the 1950 Pioneers of Music series on NBC. Moshe Paranoff conducted the orchestra in this program before an audience of young people from junior high and private schools in the area.
Songs from New England colleges.
Bells of Dartmouth, give a round for the college on the hill, for the long line of her and the loyal sons who love her. Give a round with a will.
Men of Dartmouth. The Dartmouth Glee Club sings the Dartmouth alma mater to begin another in the current series of concerts brought to you each Sunday at this time by Monsanto of Boston, part of the worldwide Monsanto Chemical Company.
They have the silver in their hearts, the new wind in their veins, and the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains, and the granite
from Webster Hall on the Dartmouth campus in Hanover, New Hampshire, Paul R. Zeller directs the Dartmouth Glee Club in a program which includes several college songs popular here in New England. Now one of the finest and best-known songs on the Dartmouth campus. Leslie Richard of Portland, Maine is the baritone soloist as we hear the famous Hanover Winter Song.
Oh, a song by the fire, past the pipes, past the boat. Oh, a song by the fire, with a skull, with a skull.
Leonard Patricelli wrote and produced songs from New England colleges. Mr. Patricelli, I'm sure you recall this series fondly.
Yes, that was a series that ran 4 years and involved three men, really, from this station. Bob Tyrrell is the announcer, Al Jackson is the engineer, and myself is the writer and producer. Mm-hmm. And we traveled an average of 23 colleges each winter. We'd start around the last week in October, and we'd go right through to March or so, or April. And we would actually produce the programs from the college campus, wherever it might be, Dartmouth, the University of Maine, Yale, etc. And it entailed our leaving in snowstorms, coming back in ice storms, and we had many a narrow escape on the road. It's one of the, I think, one of the finest program series we ever had on WTIC radio.
The 1950 got off to an auspicious start when the Mile of Dimes collected $86,724.40, a new record of well over 9 miles of dimes. One of broadcasting's highest awards came to the station when on May 4, 1950, WTIC was the recipient of a George Foster Peabody citation, naming the program Mind Your Manners as the most outstanding broadcast in the nation for young people. Another award came quickly to the Mind Your Manners program with the presentation of a first-place award in the 14th Annual American Exhibition of Education Radio Programs conducted by Ohio State University. Yet another award, a Freedom Foundation Honor Medal, was presented to WTIC in 1951, primarily as a result of the station's 1950 election night broadcasting, plus its consistent endeavor to encourage the public to exercise the right to vote. Other broadcasts, which were also considered in determining the award, were Yale Interprets the News, Your Senator from Connecticut, and the weekly United Nations feature in the Radio Bazaar. 1951 found American GIs in Korea. In southern New England, the 43rd Division was called up to active duty.
It's all aboard with the 43rd. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ed Anderson speaking to you from the Morgan Street siding in Hartford. We're down here this evening. The Special Events Department of WTIC has set up its equipment to bring you by transcription a description of the departure of Connecticut elements of the 43rd Division. And you can hear in the background the music of the lead band as the 1040 section of the Connecticut 43rd takes off. One element has already taken off at 10:20. Now, this group coming into the Morgan Street siding will leave at approximately 10:40. You can hear the siren of the police car as it leads the section down into the yards here. There's a crowd now. There are many hundreds of people down here, and I can just see over their heads the two flags, the state flag and the American flag, coming down the line, and they are being carried by a detachment of the Hartford Police Force. Now, we're going to try to pick up the identity of that band whose music we can hear. There they go. We've just stepped down close to one of these cars here, and they've turned off, and we can just see a couple of bass horns, and that is all. I was told that that is the governor's foot guard. We also know that there probably is another band in the lineup consisting of members of the Hartford Local 400 of the Musicians Union. Now, that might be the group. You can hear them playing Hail, Hail, the game's all, the gang is all here. And here come the advanced men of the 43rd Division marching to their places along the siding here. Three officers here. I couldn't quite pick up that gentleman's rank. That may be Colonel Wozinski leading his troops into the yard. Now there are a lot of wives and fathers and brothers, a lot of girlfriends hanging on to the arms of these GIs as they come in. We will have to report somewhat grim-faced into the siding here to take their positions in these Pullman or in these coaches, which will take them down to Camp Pickett, Virginia.
Working on a tip from NBC, WTIC stayed on the air past normal sign-off hours the night of Wednesday, April 10th, 1951, to bring Southern New England the first word of General MacArthur's dismissal. Early the next morning, Bob Steele was on the street with a portable tape recorder getting the views of the man on the street. It was a big step from the streets of Hartford to the brick road that comprises the famed Oval Racetrack at Indianapolis, but Bob made it on May 25th to preview the 1951 Indianapolis Speedway Classic and feedback interviews with drivers like Maury Rose, the 51 winner. After 5 years and 8 months on the air, Cinderella Weekend bowed from the scene on May 1st, 1953. In its time, 1,460 shows had been broadcast, with 146,000 people in the studio audience, and 578 people had received expense-paid weekends in New York City. Do you remember June 9th, 1953? The residents of Worcester, Massachusetts, will never forget that afternoon when the sky grew dark and dumped heavy rain and hail on the city, and from the clouds emerged the black funnel of a tornado. A WTIC special events crew sped to the scene. Announcer Bob Tyrrell, engineer Fred Edwards, program manager Leonard Patricelli, and news director Tom Eaton were on the scene all night. Arriving back in the studios at 6 the next morning, they put together a number of special reports made from recordings done during the long night.
The time is 5 minutes to 4 a.m., June the 10th. We're sitting now in the hall of Sanford Riley Hall at Worcester Tech, where a number of the evacuees are spending a rather restless night. Again, a reminder that it's almost 4 o'clock, some of the people still up, some of the people that went through this storm from beginning to end and thank God for their lives. It's our chance now to talk to some of these people. Sir, can I have your name?
Douglas Parrell.
And your wife beside you, her name?
Lucy Parrell.
And we met you folks just outside your room, and we're thankful to say that the whole family is together. Now tell us about the other folks in the room.
Well, there's my three boys. There's David, the oldest, is 9. There's Douglas, who's 8. And there's Joseph, that's 7. And now Douglas is the only one that's injured. He got thrown up against the wall, and he fractured his collarbone.
All right, you told us that you're a Fuller Brush man. We have a fondness for the Fuller Brush Company since their home office is in our city in Hartford, and you are out working today.
That's right. In fact, the matter is, I had one of my better days up on one of the streets in the territory, Osceola Avenue, and I understand it's been completely wiped out.
Mm-hmm. Your home was in the development that we visited about an hour ago.
That's right, 19 Great Brook Valley Avenue.
What time did you get home, Doug?
I got home, about 10 minutes of 5.
All right, tell us, what indication did you have that there was a storm on the way?
Well, I was out, I took the afternoon, the late afternoon off, and I went up to see Holy Cross play Boston College in baseball. Of course, I thoroughly enjoyed the afternoon. It was quite a victory for Holy Cross. But then it started to cloud up around the seventh inning, so I thought, well, I better leave and beat the traffic home. Well, on the way home, it got tremendously hot, as if I said to myself that this looks like one of these real electrical storms. So I just get home, and these terrific hailstones with the size of marbles, at least, were falling. Not many, but they were coming down.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in the house, and I got the children. They were already in the house.
Oh, they had been out playing.
They had been out playing, and we got them in the house, and along with most of the neighbors, got all their children in. And we also had a woman visiting us, so I suggested that she stay, Mrs. Donahoe, stay until after the storm. And just then, I heard this terrific noise coming. It sounded like as if it was about 1,000 airplanes flying overhead. Pardon. Mm-hmm. And also, I felt a tremendous pressure on our ears, and I couldn't figure it out. And then before I had a chance to figure it out, we looked over the top of the project, and we saw these tremendous low black cloud that was just enveloping the whole thing. And then it struck. So the quickest thing that we could think of was to get the kids in this little corridor and the women folks and have them lay down on the floor, and then all the windows and the sides, everything started coming through, and you couldn't hear, you couldn't do nothing for about 4 minutes.
Hmm.
And my wife, who was a real soldier through it all, and the kids never even whimpered. In fact, I think they thought it was quite a lark.
Now, kids are pretty good soldiers anyway.
Yeah, I think they're better than most of us older people.
I think that's right. We noticed when we were over there in the development that all of the clocks stopped at exactly 15 seconds after 5:15. Would you say that's about the time?
That was about it, because I got home, it was between 10 of and 5 o'clock, and I wasn't home very long when this disaster struck.
On June 25th, 1954, WTIC microphones were at the Bushnell Memorial Hall when Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts delivered the Connecticut State Democratic Convention's keynote address. Hurricanes Carol and Edna breezed through southern New England in 1954, presenting additional challenges to the station's special events crew. And it was in September that plans were announced to begin taking weather information from the newly formed Travelers Weather Research Center. In 1945, just 9 years earlier, WTIC listeners had heard Conrad Bacon, a scientist who had been engaged in the development of the world's first atomic bomb, discuss the atom with Professor André Schenker.
Well, what about all these stories we see in the newspapers about moving a ship from New York to Liverpool on a small satchel of summed up atoms or some things of that sort? How doesn't that seem ridicule?
It was now 1954, and in Groton, Connecticut, a submarine was being launched that would sail on and under the seas using much less than that satchel full of atomic fuel. Bob Tyrrell described the scene on the banks of the Thames River as Mamie Eisenhower presented the traditional bottle of champagne to the bow of the Nautilus.
Mamie Eisenhower again has taken a firm grip on the bottle of champagne, looking over the bow with anticipation and anxiety as we are.
All right, here she goes. Wait a minute.
Here it goes. She is drawn back. Drawn back. We're waiting. Hope that she'll be able to hear the splash. She's brought it back again. I think that Mrs. Eisenhower is a very good prospect for our...
Here we go.
There she goes!
The decade 1945 to 1955 saw the nation return to peacetime, but it was also host to a bloody police action in Korea. A wartime hero now led his country as President of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower. The world was learning to live with the atom, and an occasional rampage by Dame Nature had brought southern New Englanders closer together as communities rebuilt from hurricanes and tornadoes. The world of science marched on giant steps through the decade, bringing previously unimaginable advances to the world of electronic communications. And the people of the world's nations were now within hearing distance of one another. Throughout the land, the voice of every broadcaster became an indispensable factor in everyday living.
Tomorrow, during this same time period, we'll be taking an audio visit to the decade 1955-1965. Reminiscences and comments by some of the voices heard over WTIC in the past 10 years. The final chapter in our chronology of The Broadcaster at 40.